Dan Jones. Welcome to the Back on the Bus podcast. All right, everyone. For everyone who might not know Dan Jones, this is a character that was part of the Green Edge operation, creator of the Backstage Pass, which in my opinion revolutionized the whole cycling media world, where we started to get a hint of the characters that are involved in this crazy sport, not in just the typical boring interviews where, you know, you talk about your team and everyone did great and your fucking equipment's awesome and all this bullshit that we know, like when we watch it, you're just kind of like, yeah, the guy just has to say that. And I always hated that about cycling, was that was the tricky part, to be an individual, because you represented 30 other riders and then like a whole organization of, so you were always careful with what you said. But Jonesy, as he's known in our world there, he found a way to bring out the real true characters of the guys and make them feel comfortable sharing who they are in front of the camera. And I want to tell a little story. In 2012, when I joined the team, I knew that, you know, the team was kind of changing the template, you know, as far as having this friggin' media guy around. And I hated that shit. It cracked me because I was like, I don't want a friggin' camera in my face all the time. And, you know, as I started to get to know Jonesy and watched him interact with the guys, he had this crazy skill to kind of just make everyone feel comfortable. And I found that that was really Jonesy's talent, was being in this very strange, you know, it's not his background. Cycling is not his world. Yet he's hanging around with all these skinny freaks in a tight situation on the bus when most of the guys don't want any extra staff there. And he's bopping around with the camera, giving interviews and, you know, just shooting the shit. And so Jonesy, I've kind of gone on a long tirade here. Just to really
keep it going. I'm loving it. It's all positive.
But it's very true, man. And so Jonesy also right now he's running the Detour podcast with Iffy, John Trevorrow, and also the Social Distance podcast with my friend Sam Bewley and George Bennett, and that's also good for some laughs. But Jonesy, could you just kind of give us a backstory? Because my memories of how you got into cycling seem so Wild West and just cowboy-esque, like you just kind of powered your way in there in the Tour de France, and you know, you're a guy that just, you know, wasn't afraid to take risks and didn't say no. Like you went after it. So give us a background of how the hell this all happened.
Well, it all started out of desperation. You know, I was at film school and I just wanted an opportunity to make films. And my father used to watch the Tour de France, and you know, I had to watch it from 6 to 6:30. Cause remember in the '90s, like the dad controlled what the family ate, controlled what we watched on TV. Yeah. You know, you lived precariously through the old man. And I had to watch these.
If it was going to be MASH, you had to watch 2 hours of MASH.
That's it. That's it. And if mum dished up a shit batch of meatloaf, we never saw meatloaf again. You know, he controlled everything. So Tour de France was part of that. In the 90s, I used to watch the half-hour highlights, and we only had one TV and three channels in Sale, where I grew up in country Victoria, just out of Melbourne. And so in 2004, I remember being in Sale, and mum said, oh, has your dad told you the news? And I said, what's that? I thought he had some illness or whatever. She goes, no, he's going to the Tour de France. And I was like, what? He goes, yeah, he found out this guy that does this sort of dodgy system, John Trevorrow. And if you
what?
If
you're dodgy?
Yeah, dodgy. Doesn't fit. Anyone that you introduced me for, John Trevorrow is a former cyclist who then became a journalist, and he used to get people press passes to the tour. And he would, if you paid him a bag of cash, he could get you a press pass to say that you're like a driver for Sport 927. And that would get you over the barricades and access that you can't get anywhere else. All of a sudden, the Tour de France thought that the Geelong Advertiser was the biggest paper in the world, because there was 12 contingent of 12 people traveling around the tour covering it. It's this small paper out of Melbourne. So my dad was part of the Geelong Advertiser contingent. I think he was like the driver or whatever. So anyway, they brought back all this home video footage, and I thought, oh my God, this would be an amazing documentary, you know. And I was inspired by films like American Movie, which was low budget but really great story arc. And I thought, I can do this. But I was really confident. You know, that hasn't changed. Just always back yourself. And so I pitched an idea in 2005, 3 weeks before the Tour de France was scheduled to leave. And at the time, Lance was going to win 7. And John said, mate, I'd love to take you, but no, it's too late. Like, it's not going to happen. I said, let me do a concept. And I stayed up all night and typed up this concept, and John was going to be the star of the show. So when he read that, he was like, shit, we have to make this happen. and so we pitched it around, and he had some sponsors from a small cycling event he did. So we tried to raise 40 grand, but we needed a press pass. And he just happened to get a phone call from SBS that said, oh, we're going live, and they're the Australian broadcaster. We're going live to air for the first time, but we don't have enough crew. And John said, well, we're going to do a documentary, just lying. And he goes, oh, really? Does that guy shoot on a Digi Betacam? And he's writing it down. He goes, yeah, he's got one of those. Yeah. He rings me and he goes, mate, you got a Digi Betacam? I said, piss off, mate. That's like 80 grand. The lenses alone are like 50 grand. And he goes, well, you better find out how much they are to hire because you're going on the tour. I said, well, fucking hell. So I went into this place to hire it. I said, I need a Digi Betacam. And the guy goes, oh, what do you need that for? I said, I'm covering the Tour de France. He goes, oh, that's a good gig, mate. What lenses do you use? I'll fit it out. I'm thinking, lenses? What the fuck's he talking about? I don't know. Chuck a Canon on it. He goes, Canon? Why do you use Canon lenses? They're shit. Okay. Ah, you know, I've got to deal with Canon. They're good to me. But what do you usually use? He goes, oh, Fuji. Oh, yeah, chuck a Fuji on it, mate. He goes, all right, what sticks do you use? I go, sticks? What the fuck's he talking about? Tripod. He goes, 18s or 20s? I go, 20s, mate. He goes, oh, the big dogs. These are these massive fucking tripod. So I've got all this kit together. And then the night before we're scheduled to leave, we've got this. So we're going. All of a sudden he rings me. He says, right, we're going to the tour. And I'm thinking, oh, shit. Is this good or bad? Because I'm bluffing my way through. Up until this point, I've done wedding videos and corporate videos. We have this meeting with this guy who's paying for it, and he thinks this guy's a hoax. You know, I roll up wearing a flannelette shirt and ripped jeans for this expensive boardroom, you know. And he says, what documentaries have you done before? And I said, well, I'm actually in pre-production on a documentary on Lotto at the moment. He goes, what do you mean? I said, you know, people that have won Tats Lotto and how they blew it and that. He goes, oh, that's interesting. Pre-production doesn't mean shit. I just Googled it. So anyway, I downloaded this budget off the internet and just filled that in. And the guy goes, what's that stock? I go, oh, it's an audio stock, mate. We want to make sure the audio's, you know, mint. I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm
saying. So you're just anyway, bullshitting your
bullshitting
way in 100%.
Just bullshitting. So we get to the tour and it hits me on the plane. Oh, fuck, I've never used this camera before. I don't even know how to turn it on. I better start working it out when we land. So I turn it on. I can't work the zoom out. I'm thinking, oh, no, the camera's broken. But it was just a button underneath. Anyway, we go and start filming interviews with, like, Cadell Evans and that. I hand it into SBS. I'm thinking, great footage. I got John talking with Cadell, and I'm wide and I'm swinging everywhere. And I hand the tape in, and the guy, Mike Tomolaris, who worked for SBS, he watches it and he pulls me aside and he loses it. He goes, mate, what the fuck is that vision that I just watched? Have you ever worked in broadcast or anything before? And it was that point I thought, just come clean. I said, listen, mate, I'll be honest with you. I haven't. I've just done wedding videos and even they were shit. And he looks at me and he goes, oh, fuck. I said, listen, it's not dead. Can you get your cameraman to train me up on how to shoot?
It's not dead. You're convincing him, like, it's all okay.
We'll be right. Yeah, we'll be fine. That. So then I had to get an hour training session with the cameraman on site. Her name was Honey, and she took me through how to shoot. And then we were okay. But then after that, I had 20 hours of vision. I stuck together this documentary, and we actually showed it at the Melbourne Film Festival. It didn't do too bad. And then that's when I met Jerry Ryan. So I went to the tour again in 2007 and struck up this relationship with Jerry. And then we covered, you know, Fox Sports. We did all the coverage for them. And then when he started Green Edge, like what you're saying at the opening, Swaino, he wanted me to come on board. He said, I'm starting this team, Dan, and I want you to cover it. And in the first year, we can maybe do a documentary, but you know what you're doing and just do it. Because I'd done a cycling website. And I looked at the sport the same, Swaino. Like, it bored me. The interviews bored me. I only cared about the characters. But I also knew that when I joined the team, if I had to put on the cap of a rider, if I was a rider, I wouldn't want me there. So I said to the group at the very beginning, this is going to be built on trust. If you don't trust me, then this whole thing doesn't work. And over time, I'll earn that trust. And once I've got it, that's the most sacred thing for this whole project, because if you don't want me around, then I can't get good stuff. So I thought, if I just commit to being myself, I should be okay, you know? And that's what I think happened.
So I really want to delve into that, though, because that's kind of the really key to this whole era, where I really do believe you changed the way people viewed cyclists at that world tour level, because most of the time it's just kind of these robot drones and it's the same shitty answers. And so what I want to like understand is like, you're not a guy that's immersed in cycling. You know, you did the tour, you filmed some of this stuff, and you were just on a wild ride, a guy who takes risks and like, you know, has big confidence. And I like that. But now you're in this, like, so Jerry, who's just a fantastic dude, a guy who's been behind Australian cycling and then just, you know, basically the blood of that team, fantastic dude. He has faith and belief in you to be able to pull this off. And I'm sure you guys didn't have a real vision of what that was actually going to be. It was kind of like, because Jerry is a smart businessman. He had belief in you. In some way, he saw something in you, right, to pull this off. And now what I want to understand is you're going to your first races. I mean, that first year in 2012, we pulled off some big things early on in the year in Tirreno Adriatico and then Milan San Remo and these things, you know, like in the early season. And, you know, we had that big camp in Oz, and you would have done the Tour Down Under stuff. But I guess what I'm trying to get out of you is, what was that like for you? I know you're one of those personable guys and one of those guys who kind of mesh into any kind of group, and you're really the life of the party kind of guy. But did you have like insecurities? Like, what did you feel like when you're on the bus? And there's like, because the crazy thing about cycling is there's like that, especially with Aussies, there's that like kind of party, like everyone's having a good time and like things are high and everyone's laughing, but it's highly stressful too, right? There's moments when it's like, you know, it can be pretty dour on the bus and guys are pretty like, whew, serious and blown out or whatever the fuck it is. So yeah, I would love to hear kind of your stories in that first part of the year, because that was the make or break for you on this new role.
Firstly, I had a blank canvas, which is really rare. So it's really rare that someone like Jerry would go, I'm not telling you what to do. You just go out and do what you do.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen. And then I realized early on it was intimidating, because you've got guys like Baden Cook who don't really open up to many people, and he's this sort of macho. He's, you know, he's a bit of a
bulldog.
By the
way, he's got stories coming out of the yin yang. So it'd be great if he did, because like his stories are second to none.
And then you've got all these, these internationals.
Did you know any of the guys, like any of the guys before you started this?
Yeah, I knew Stewie, I knew Alan Davis, I knew Whitey, all through the Fox Sports stuff. And that helped a lot, because they can sort of fast track that whole, the feel of it all. So Mitch Docker, I leant on the guys early on that I knew I had a relationship with. And I was doing cooking videos and all this sort of stuff. But I worked out pretty early on, if I don't do something different here, I'm not going to have a job. And I fell into the trap early on at Down Under of doing post-race interviews and all this boring shit. I'm like, if I just keep doing this, anyone can step into this role and I'm screwed. So when I went to Tour of Qatar, I was like, I know how to make mini little docos. Why don't I try and do that like each day? And then we did the first one at a women's race at Tour of Qatar. Then I thought, I'll do that again with the men. And that worked. And then I went to Torino for the time trial for races that we were targeting, stuck that together. We won. It worked. And then it was when we did Milan San Remo and started this backstage pass sort of concept. That's when it really took off. And when people saw the reaction in the car with Whitey and the screams and all that, that's when the whole thing exploded. And then when we went to California, I was always thinking of the Tour de France. If I could pull off doing this every day at the tour as a one-man band, this thing will explode. But I knew it was going to be hard work. So I thought I'll trial it 7 days in a row. If I can get through that, I can get through the tour because it's just going to be three blocks of that. I did it at Robbie's last race in California. Almost killed me, but I got it done. And I thought I need to tighten the formula. So it got to the point where you had to be so meticulous with every facet of your day. So when you'd film stuff, you'd be cutting on the bus. When you got in, you'd have to capture and charge your batteries. And you had all these links in the chain that you had to get right or the whole thing would fall over. And that we got through that 2012 Tour de France. And the hardest thing I found, Sueno, was exactly what you said. When it's all up and about and it's good, it's easy. But when it's difficult, it's all about this sort of zones. And I look at the team buses, it's like radioactive. You know, you go in, shoot your stuff, get out. Otherwise, the levels are so high, you're gonna blow up. So that was different. And also, I found difficult, Sueno, even with you. We'd have all these amazing conversations at the back of the bus, and then it was hard to switch between that's a personal conversation or that's a bit. You know, so when you'd hear this really good thread, sometimes I'd say to you, "Hey, Sueno, do you mind if I flick the camera on?" You didn't have to say anything. You could see your brain going, I forgot he's still got a job here. Like he still has to film content. You'd go, yeah, okay, mate. All right, no worries. And it was disappointing because it's sort of like your insights, I knew the viewer would love it, but at the same time, you want to keep stuff personal. There's always this sort of you tug of war, it felt like, you know?
Yeah, well, I have to touch on that. Like it's hard. It's always hard to replicate something that like is a real discussion amongst friends. You know, because then you feel like, okay, is this a show? Like, I can't do that. Mm. But you had a real knack for capturing that. But one of the things I wanted to bring up, how you gain that trust is just that person you are. You're able to speak with anyone about anything. And I always loved, you know, when we'd be on a race, I knew that like when you'd come back and we'd have a chat, it wasn't about bike racing. It wasn't about anything. It was like just about whatever, man, like a million different topics. But that was always refreshing. And that's also what I loved about Jerry. You know, when he would come to the races, is like you could sit and have a chat with him. And it wasn't like this weird, you know, I think a lot of teams would have had that real weird vibe with the owner being there and he's kind of judging and looking at everyone and you're kind of afraid to talk to him. But Jerry was the same, like just that open book, talk about anything. And a lot of us are so like you're racing so much. It's your life. You don't really want to talk about that stuff. So it was always so refreshing. And that's how you gained my trust. So I was always maybe I was difficult, but I always loved, you know, to work with you because I knew what you were trying to do, you know.
Mm. Now, I found that every character like once you got to know them, you could drop them in situations. And that was part of my job. Like everyone would say, how much planning goes into backstage? I'd say nothing because that kept me on my toes. And then everything that you talked about was current. It was fresh.
It was
and
authentic.
You had to think on your feet.
You
did. Yeah.
As soon as you start planning something, you kind of ruin the whole vibe of it, right? Because then you think you have control of how it should be directed.
That's right. And when you know the characters well enough, like Ween Dog was a great character, you know, you could drop him in any situation. And I realized that he loved the role of being the psycho, you know, you could piss him off really easy and just keep hammering the dog angle. And people mopped that up, you know, they mopped it up. They loved it. And then you bounce him off with like guys like Chavez, who's this sweet, you know, he plays the game with his smile and all this sort of stuff. You have these contrasting characters all the time. And the other thing is if you got the feeling that certain riders didn't want to be part of it, you didn't have to make them part of it, you know. There were some races where people were like, shit, I didn't even know he was riding in that Grand Tour. Yeah, because he probably didn't want to be part of the backstage. He just was over it. That's fine. You didn't have to force people to be part of it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So as it evolved and, you know, like it was Milan San Remo that kind of triggered that first real backstage pass that took it off from that point. And then did you get some sort of feedback from the staff and, you know, Jerry and that this is the direction they want to go? Like when did that actually kick off?
Jerry rang me after Milan San Remo and he said, oh, Dan, you know, that was a great video, great insights, mate. You're doing a great job or whatever. And then I just remember being so burnt out after that because it was full on, you know, the whole day. And that I had to go to – because I didn't have a home that year. They used to call me Homeless Dan.
So yeah.
Put all my clothes in a bag and just stay wherever. I remember I stayed for 4 days with Brian Nygaard in Luca and he kicked me out because I took a slash with the door open. And for people in Canada, that's urinate. And
he's pretty proper. He's pretty proper Danish fella, right? So you guys are peas in a pod, I would say.
Oh, mate. I just even go, dude. Like I, you know, killed his cat. And after that, it just didn't work out. But I remember after Milan San Remo going into the European training scene and doing this horrible video with the women's team. It was like them going around doing questions or whatever. And it was just terrible. And I remember posting it and Brian rang me and he said, dude, what is that? Yeah. And I remember snapping at him going, oh, mate, oh, I'm doing another man. And it made me reset and go, mate, the other thing is you do a really good video. You're only good as your next one. You know, you do a good one like that and then you throw up a bag of shit. But you're sort of damaging your brand. So it's sort of like stay on job, stay on message and keep working hard. Like don't take shortcuts, you know. But Jerry, in terms of the direction, they never – once it was sort of organically evolving, and I look at the early backstages to the ones now, you talk about over the journey, we did over 500. I think it was like 530.
It's crazy.
And we're doing over 100 a year. What it did is it refined your sharpness that you can't teach. So I always talk about the rule of 10,000 hours or whatever. Over a while, you knew what was good content. You knew what waffled on. You knew what was shit. And that was just from doing it over and over and over again. And it just naturally evolved that way. And then we started obviously throwing in the music videos and that. But I noticed on your podcast, Wayne, and this intuition, you've got another host here who has not been able to chime in. So you've got to read people, mate. So Ryan, what would you like insights wise, mate?
Well, this is actually
the podcast as well.
No, I think you know, one of the things I think that actually we don't understand is you just spoke about 100 videos a year. So you were on the road at least 100 days a year then, right?
Yeah. And he was homeless Dan. He was homeless Dan.
Yeah.
But I mean, from your guys' perspective, how okay, whatever, sit like 80, 60, that's a lot of race days, but you're almost, you know, probably doubling that with training camps and all the stuff. Like how that toll of that amount of travel following the team around making these videos.
You can do it when you're
late
single.
Late nights. Yeah. I remember he would be editing on the friggin', like this guy, there's no way I would figure any of that shit out. Like that's kind of known, but it's pretty incredible the quality of thing he was like video that he was able to put together with all kinds of extra stuff thrown in there on the bus, shitty Wi-Fi in France and Italy and all these things. Like I always remember you, Jonesy, like being excited that you were able to upload a friend because, you know, with bad internet, uploading is kind of the worst thing ever, right?
Terrible. Just frustration over the. I can imagine trying to make a fucking simple phone call and the. Yeah,
I remember losing it at Lionel, our French director in 2012, because he'd organised this French SIM card and it ran out of data by like stage 8, and I said to him, like white in the face, mate, you need to get this reduced. I need more data, and he never got round to it. And I said to him the next night, I said, "How'd you go with that day?" He goes, "Hey, man, I've got a job to do. I'm doing this." And I said, "Nah. No, you fucked me." Like just lost it, you know?
Yeah.
Because then you're relying on the hotel. And back in those days, like you're staying at mountaintop places that, you know, internet just doesn't exist. You can still hear the bing, bing, in the background.
Yeah.
But it was so stressful. But, yeah, you just – I think once you burst through a period of work ethic where it was really hard but you got through it, you almost – it's not like you become addicted to it. You just become battle-hardened. So you were quite prepared going into a Grand Tour going, shit, there's going to be nights when I'm going to be editing till literally 4 a.m. and I'll be up at 7 and we go again and I'd sleep in the car or sleep in the bus or just you're trying to find pockets of sleep. And I remember what I used to love about Sueno is he'd have all these deep philosophies on things like sleep. And, you know, you'd go, man, one extra hour of sleep, you don't have to take any supplements or you don't have to worry about this and that. That extra hour of sleep will fix everything. And you'd have those face masks. And I used to love those insights, as you said, that had nothing to do with cycling. But you'd be sitting there going, shit, this bloke, like, he's a deep thinker. And I remember looking out the windows some mornings when you'd be first on the bus, you see Swaino doing like fucking Tai Chi or something. It looked like a scene out of Kickboxer. You know, when Van Damme is training for Tong Po and he's doing all this shit, I'm going, who is this guy? I love it.
So early days, though, between, like, would you typically stay on the bus during the stage? Because, like, before, later, I remember, like, Julian Dean, you guys would be jumping around all over the place. But
yeah, early days, you'd keep it simple. But then it evolved where it's like, you're trying to find almost zones of the race that they don't see on TV. So bus pre-start, then out on the race route. And then they were some of the funnest days with Julian in the car where he was like the serial Tour de France scab. And we try and trade guitars for
Julian's a legend.
Bread.
Such a sweet dude.
Absolute legend. Yeah. And then, you know, one of my favorite videos was Tour de France stage 15. Tour de France 2015 stage 20 when we went up Alpe d'Huez and we focused on all the corners of support. And it was one of the best days because it was just fun, you know. And once you break the back out of that routine and you can have fun whilst doing a full-on job and you know that the fans are interacting with you, you know, the amount of people that would come up and go, who's that guy, you know, because that day that the Kiwi supporter didn't know who Julian was. But to have guys that were willing to put shit on themselves was a game changer, you know. If their personality is, I don't care, man, and I could just be myself. That's what makes made the team likable, you know. Guys willing to, like, yes, I took element of risk, but if I didn't have the people around me to buy into it, none of it would work. And once the riders and the staff and everyone bought into it, we're away. And the secret sauce with all this, you can always replicate videos that are emotional, informative, drama. That's fine. Anyone can do that. It's the comedy. If you can get people to laugh in an authentic way, no one can replicate that the way that we did, because that's the secret sauce.
Yeah, which is that just leads me to this memory I always bring up, and it makes me laugh to this day, where it was the 2013 Tour de France. We're there in Corsica, you know, pre-tour, and we're doing that bloody AC/DC video. You know, and you got the Astana guys staying in our place. I think it was just us in Astana. And these guys look like they've just been in depression camp, right? Like they're just emaciated, wasted away. They're like, you know, they're the ultimate bikers. But they're not out in the fucking parking lot doing high kicks with shitty plastic guitars and wigs on. You know, and I'll never forget, like I said, we've all kind of done our training. You got us out there in the fucking parking lot with all the staff. And, you know, we're putting on this show and those guys are coming back from some crazy ride, you know, just dour faces, just, you know, and they're looking at us like, what the fuck are these idiots up to, you know? And that's just, you know, you changed cycling in that sense. For me anyways, you made that shit fun, you know?
I just remember that when the bus hit the finish line and there was those really tense 2 days and the air conditioning broke and it was just a shit show. Jerry says to me, he goes, hey, we're not releasing that fucking video, Dan. We look like a fucking joke. And I said, Jerry, I've spent 6 months putting this together. He goes, no. You can fucking forget that. And then when Gero won the stage and we won the team time trial and we had the yellow jersey.
Oh, things are
okay. I just breathed a sigh of relief that we could finally release this thing that had been putting together, because the first one we did, Call Me Maybe, that exploded. And, you know, I remember when we released that, I had to go to the Montreal, Quebec. So I'd left for the reaction at the Tour of Spain. So I didn't see it all. And Steve, he goes, what the fuck have you done over here, Dan?
His social media blew right up, eh?
Mate, it blew up so bad that it completely shut down the Green Edge email accounts. Like, it blocked the server. And I got an email in November that year from MTV asking if they could show 10 seconds of that video for a tribute to Carly Rae Jepsen and the Call Me Maybe video. MTV Music Awards, that's like a billion people watch that. I read that email and my heart rate went through the roof. I rang Brian Nygaard and I go, mate, this is fucking huge. You understand how big this is? And then I go, hang on. I remember seeing that awards show a month ago. Oh, fuck, when was this email? They sent it in September, but the email server blew up.
Yeah.
And, you know, instead of just keeping that to myself, I told Jerry, who fucking got stuck into someone at the, you know, back end staff, how did that happen? We caused this shit show. But, yeah, I just remember when we released that AC/DC video, my plan was the first rest day, we had the yellow jersey. It just, I knew it was going to go nuts, but we didn't get permission from AC/DC. So we labeled it as a tribute.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, Jonesy, because you always were kind of sinking in this kind of, you know, really popular music. And I don't know if I overheard you saying this, because I know nothing about this stuff, but you changed like the metronome. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Like, so if you like speed it up or slow it down just micro, the algorithms can't pick it up. So you were able to play this. And then YouTube's probably figured this out. But then through that time as well, you like the bloody organizers were starting to crush the access to footage, right? Which also really made it difficult. So things became a lot shittier as you, like, you know, you kept running into these kind of obstacles, right? As these big corporations started figuring out how to keep guys like you down, you know?
Well, that was a pain in the ass because, you'd speed up the audio, but you didn't want them to sound like chipmunks. So you had to sort of find this sweet balance. And then you'd rip these live versions. And I remember they said at the end of 2012, you can't use commercial music anymore. So I started, I bought this whole stock of shit music, did a couple of videos. I'm like, nah, fuck that. I'm going back to the live versions.
Back to the show.
And if we get in shit, I'll just quit. You know, so I did
your
that.
Was Dan anyways. I mean, there's, you know, you'll figure it out.
And when we released the AC/DC video, I mean, it blew up. We were mentioned 8 times more than any other team on social on that rest day, and we didn't have the jersey. We didn't have anything. Day later, we got an email from AC/DC's management saying, where did you get the permission to use this? And then we were like, I said to Nygaard, I think we could be in shit here. So we emailed him back and said, it was just a tribute, you know, we're sorry, and buttered the bread. And they said, okay, we'll give you a retrospective license for $500 and you can use that on YouTube. And then it blew up again 2 weeks later. They said someone was denied able to use that song. I reckon someone from the band or someone close to AC/DC said, we don't want fucking blokes in Lycra dancing around our stuff. Kill it. So they killed it. But then the worst for me was when, exactly what you said, Swaino, suddenly we've built this machine and it looks like it's making money. We weren't making money. It was just exposure. And it was actually exposure for the race. But then 2016, when I rolled up to the Giro, the night before, we're told by the race organizers, who now have IMG managing all their rights, you can't film in the bus. You can't film, use any race vision. That's all their domain. They own that space.
Yeah.
You can't film at hotels. I said to Shane Bannon, what the fuck am I going to do, mate? I can't do my job now. So I cracked it and just filmed at the bus anyway and did pre-race stuff. And that's when I decided, you know what? I'm going to stick it up. I'm going to recreate the race with toys. And we're going to run this video to show how ridiculous this is.
And so, Luka Mezjak was one of your best voice men, I have to say.
And you talk about Astana looking in. The same thing happened. We're staying with, I think, another team. And they walk past the hallway and there's Matt White with these toys and these lights. And I'm filming him and they're going, what the fuck are they doing now? And we posted the video and Cycling Weekly did an article. Orica Greenedge had the last laugh with race restrictions and recreate a stage with toys. And everyone's going, oh, what a fucking joke. Giro, fucking, yeah, blah. Anyway, they had the last laugh because it's like mafia. They went and blocked three videos from the 2014 Giro the next day where Weendog won, Bling had the jersey, all these key videos from old editions to go, oh, you think you can outplay us? Well, fuck you. People can't see the videos now. It didn't stop me. I did like 3 versions of the toy video just to go, well, what are you going to do? I can't do anything here, you know? And that was the year that obviously Esteban ran second at the Giro. That was fucking heartbreaking that day. I was so pissed that it was the saddest part about the whole thing was we knew Esteban, remember he had that cough?
Yes.
And we knew bronchitis, he was getting like, yeah, he was getting sick. And I remember he was coughing on the bus and he said to the group, "Don't worry, guys, I'm fine. It's not a problem." But we knew. And then when we did the penultimate stage recon, we got to the top of the climb and Julian Dean rang Matt White and said, "Right, this moment here, it gets pretty hard, but I think Nibbly's going to attack. Probably should let him go." And then you've got the guys at the back that have openly said in the media, like Rigo and that, if we're there to help and we can help Esteban, we will. So the problem was is he tried to hold the wheel of Nibbly, completely blew and lost the Giro. You look back at those moments, you go, fuck, if he just held back and he had the support from those other guys, you know, the what if. But I was so pissed at the finish when the race organizer, who I fucking hated because he blocked my videos, he might have had nothing to do with it, but he was the figurehead.
Yeah.
He was like the Joe Pesci type, hugging Nibbly like it was this bloody plan or something. The cameras got me giving him the stink eye on the broadcast as I walked past, and I'm wearing this Colombian footy jersey. Yeah, it was just, I was so pissed after that race. But I said to Esteban at the end of that, because I remember on the last day he was gutted, and I said, "You know what, Esteban, sometimes, as you know, in sport, you win them, you lose them, but it's about the journey. And people have been able to see your journey through what we've done with the content. And that's the legacy piece. That's the stuff that people are going to remember. No one's going to be talking about Nibbly winning the Giro in 2016 in 5 years' time. It'll just be a stat. Whereas you have such a deeper connection." And yeah, I just remember at the time thinking, what we're doing on this journey is a time capsule. You know, in 10 years, 20 years, as long as YouTube don't go under, we're still going to be able to watch all this content, you know, and I still do to this day. I love the fact that we've captured it all, you know. It's always going to be there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like when I think of, you know, that's not really my thing to these, all that stuff. But I've said it to you before. It's like, it's a gift you've given to all of us that were part of that whole crazy team to have like a record of that era for us, right? And one of the things I wanted to bring up, which kind of blew my mind, I was listening to Mitch Docker's Life in the Peloton podcast the other day with one of the young guys, Corey Williams from Legion of LA. And he was talking about, like, because Mitch kind of brought up the backstage pass. And Corey said that, you know, he watches them all the time. He said he didn't really care about the race or whatever, where we were at, but the characters and the kind of, you know, just the vibe you were creating amongst our team. And that's a young guy that's like from a whole other era, right? Because if we think back to the big backstage pass, you know, that's like 10 years ago now, right?
Mm.
And you have, you know, one of these young guys who's kind of evolving the sport commenting like that, it kind of blew my mind, right? So it's like, it's just like you said, it is a legacy, because what you did was really kind of evolve the sport. And I've seen other teams try and mimic it, not to great success. And it's kind of crazy now that, you know, you're not doing it anymore. And I wonder, you know, like, what's your thoughts? Because I know you moved back to Oz for, you know, other reasons, right? Like getting a life, not being homeless Dan anymore. And we touched on it yesterday because we had a quick chat on the phone. And I feel like it's almost like retiring as a professional rider. Like it's something that you're really part of that family, and it's not so easy to just walk away from.
No, when I first realized that I had problems was at the end of the 2016 Vuelta. I'd started the process of sticking together All for One, and normally you'd get downtime. So normally you do the Tour de France, you'd be absolutely cooked, but you'd have 3 weeks off. And those 3 weeks gave you that time to mentally reset. I didn't have that luxury anymore. Now all my downtime was put into this documentary of sticking together a 6-year journey into 90 minutes. So I was constantly just burning the candle. I had to tell the team at the start of the Vuelta, "Guys, I'm cooked here. I can't do the start of the Vuelta. I need like time away." And that was the first signs, uh-oh, because I was doing this all by myself. And then I got to the end of the Vuelta and I remember like late nights, And I got to the final day and I went to eat dinner and I couldn't. The room was spinning. I felt sick. And I said to the doctor, I don't know what the fuck's going on with my body, man. He goes, no, you're burnt out, mate. You are seriously burnt out. Then went back to Australia, kept doing the editing. And I realized I just can't continue this. I am so fried. And I didn't realize at the time it's because I didn't have any downtime. And then I was in a relationship at the time. I found out I was going to be a father. You know, it was just this pile on. And I was, and everything was just like, my whole world is fucking spinning now. And there was pressures of, hey, you're going to leave the family for so long. When you're single and homeless, Dan, you get no responsibility but yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and then when you get all these other commitments, you're like, I can't keep doing this. And a job popped up to work full time in Australia. And I wouldn't have to film, wouldn't have to edit. I could run media back in Australia in like a corporate environment. I'd never been in that before. So I did that for a couple of years, but this sinking feeling of just, I don't know, it just didn't feel right that I'd left in that way. Like it all happened really quick and I was under so much pressure from all angles that I just sort of made this call. And even then, like I wasn't going to leave the team until I'd spoken to Jerry and I'd spoken to Shane, because it feels like you're saying goodbye to your family.
Yeah.
And the bloody bloke that I was working with, who was the boss of this like betting company, he already spoke to Jerry at a function. They were owners of Melbourne Storm, this rugby league club in Melbourne. And he said, "Ah, Jerry, yeah, I've got one of your guys coming across to work for me." I hadn't agreed to the contract at this time. And Jerry's like, "What? Who's that?" He goes, "Oh, Dan Jones." And I could only imagine Jerry's face. I hadn't spoken to him first and he heard it from someone else. And then when I rang Jerry to tell him, "Hey, Jerry, I've been offered this position, but I don't want to take it unless I've spoken to you," blah, he goes, "Nah, that's fine, mate. I get it. You got a family now. It's been a big journey. You know, no worries." He's really supportive. But it just felt so shit. And then when I was away from the sport for so many years, I just missed it, you know. I just missed the people. I didn't care about the race. I didn't care about the locations. I just missed that opportunity to connect with the riders, connect with the fans. And because I'd reset mentally, I sort of felt like – but then I had to come to this realization that everything is a journey, everything is a chapter, everything's a phase, as Alan Piper calls it. And you've got to look at it like, I really appreciate the opportunity that we all had. I appreciate the buy-in that the writers and staff gave me. And I'm happy now. Like, I appreciate that. So then when I decided, when the pandemic hit, I'd been made redundant from this job, which is good. I didn't want to work in that corporate shit anymore. But then I was like, okay, I need to get back. I need to get back into the sport. So I offered to do podcasts for the team just to reconnect. Start doing podcasts with Buells and George Bennett. Started the Detour podcast with Iffy just to get back into cycling. And then this year I went to the broadcast in Australia, SBS, and said, "Look, why don't I come over? I'm available. I'll come over to the tour and I'll do lighthearted interviews at the start, wind the riders up, and just add another dynamic to your coverage, because that's the secret sauce that's missing in a lot of cycling content, is that natural lighthearted approach to the sport where you don't care about the mechanics, you care about the characters." So the questions I'm going to be asking will probably have nothing to do with the race, but I just want to have fun. You know, it all comes down to the simple feeling of you just want to have fun. You want to enjoy. You want to have a laugh. You don't want to take things too serious, because, you know, it can all end in a split second, like the career, everything. So just go out and fucking enjoy it. Like, don't overcook this shit. Just relax, have fun. And I think this year, because I'll just be representing, they call it the couch peloton. So all the fans at home, I'm their servant. So I'm there to serve them. They give me challenges. Who do you want to interview? All that stuff. So it's going to be a different dynamic now. I'm not going to be working for a team, but I'll be working for a broadcast and just see what happens and just stay connected. That's the thing. When people walk away, you've got options. You can either stay connected with the people that you care about, or you can park it and leave it. And even you guys doing this podcast, it's a great way to still stay connected, you know, and ask angles that people wouldn't hear of, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's great to know that you're going to be back in that role. I for one will want to see that footage. Something that is just hitting me now, in the sense of, it's a pretty basic question, but it's one I'd love to hear about. Your greatest memory from that time, those Green Edge years, like, what, when you think about just like the grand tours and the monument stuff that the team pulled off a lot of wild shit that, you know, I don't think a lot of people expected. especially in that 20, you know, those early years, right? Mm. And what stands out to you? Because I know I have my things like this, these moments, right? And you'll just remember them randomly one day, whatever. But what is that for you?
I think there's probably four main ones. The first one was obviously Milan San Remo in 2012. That was the first big one. Actually, there's probably more than four, but the Call Me Maybe video, the reaction to that, the team time trial win. I remember I couldn't get into the Inner Sanctum to film it that day, and I remember asking Dave McKenzie, did they win? Did they win? And when he came back, he said, they won, and Garrow's in the yellow jersey. The emotion of that, I remember slumping on the side of the ground where the barricades was, and, you know, there's thousands of people there, and I just cried. I remember just crying for a minute. Because the enormity of what you guys had done was just too overwhelming. And I remember, obviously, Paris-Roubaix with Matt Heyman was huge because of the underdog story. And I remember saying to him the night before, oh, geez, good that you're getting a start, mate. He goes, I'm actually feeling good. I was thinking, you broke your fucking arm, mate.
You've been on the trainer, dude.
Mate, you're making up the numbers. You'll bloody do some kamikaze attack and you get spat out the ass. Like. And then obviously that Giro, Swaino, 2014 Giro, like when we finished with Dos Hombres, you know, those memories are just amazing. And you look back and you go, the best thing about sport, you can't script it. You know,
so many
of these moments that you look back and you go, if you were writing a script, what a story. You can't script this stuff. And those are the key moments through that journey where you look back and you just go, far out. Like, I was so lucky for the sliding door moment where I knew Jerry. He gave me this blank canvas, and to meet so many lifelong friends through that journey that outside of being a cyclist, you just love these people for that. Like, they're just great people, great characters. And you're going to be forever bonded, and you'll always have moments that you can bring up and go, oh, remember that. And it's always still fresh because you can go and watch it.
Yeah. You know, that's I'd have to agree with those big highlight moments there, because they are for sure, they stand out for me. Something I know a lot of boys from that team, from that era, talk about is that 2014 Giro. It stands out as such a crazy one. And I would love to kind of, because we've had a lot of discussions over the years from the guys who were involved as riders, you know, what was crazy, what stories really stood out. And I would love to hear, like, because you were watching this and you were a part of it as our group, but you weren't, you know, you were able to look, you know, from a different lens than what we were doing, because we were immersed in the fucking stress and the effort of racing, right?
This is where you have to step in, Ryan.
Yeah,
here you are.
Sorry, you just dropped out, mate.
Oh, sorry. Yeah,
you're up.
Musk internet, mate.
I would love to hear just how that was for you, being like a bystander, you know, looking at things from a different lens. You know,
well, it all started months out when I remember going for a walk with Matt White in Varese, and he was talking about, he was so confident they were going to win the team's time trial because it was fully stacked with animals, you know, and he was talking about who potentially could have the leader's jersey after that day, and, you know, throwing out names like Luke Durbridge and whatever, and we were chatting about you, Swain, and he said, you know what would be an amazing story? Swain Tooft, because of what you did to win that team time trial in 2013. And we knew your age. It was like, well, you might not get many other chances to win the jersey. And that, as a cultural thing for the team, would send such a good message, because you're such a likable guy. That is the logical decision for the leader's jersey. So that started 2 months out. And it's not like I could WhatsApp you and go, fucking get fired up, mate. You're going to get the jersey. Fucking let's go. So when I remember seeing your face when he said on the bus, guys, Swaino's going to be first across the line, it was just one quick throwaway call. And you could see the riders in the group were so happy in that moment that you were going to get that opportunity if you won it. And when you won it, that to me was so special, because just the joy that brought to everyone, you know? And then you'd ask Wendo, yo, how special is that? And he goes, ah, it's a fucking gift, mate. He's fucking lucky, eh?
But never then, want to mince the words, old Weendog, hey?
It's a fucking gift, mate. But everyone else was like, oh, mate, that's so great, you know. And I just remember then when you get it and you've got the jersey, like you look at the race so differently because you're like, we're on top of the world here, you know, this is amazing. And then you get Bling, who's a different character, to get the jersey. And then when he pulled off that stage win, when it was such, you got these sort of contrasting battles going on. You got the guys at the front that are winning, like Bling, and then you had that massive crash that stage, yeah. And you binned it. Everyone went
Lancaster,
down, and then Lancaster, and then Cam was sick. I remember after the finish,
he was vomiting. Do you remember outside the bus. He'd be in the back of the bus, wrapped in blankets, shivering, like, you know, Cam is so tough; he's never gonna like give up. But I remember like. Looking at him, he's pale as a ghost, shaking in a blanket and vomiting every, like, whatever, 10 minutes. And he's like, he's convinced he's going to get better, you know, for tomorrow. He's going to just, all he has to do is just get a little bit of sleep and some food, you know? And it's just like, wow.
But even that, you look at how many guys got crook, right? I was making those rice and tuna things for the riders. I don't even think I washed my hands. And what I remember some mornings going to the bus and Whitey go, how'd you sleep? And I go, yeah, all right, bit of bum wee this morning, but I'm all right. you know, the protocols back then. But I remember Cam getting crook. And then just one by one, like riders are dropped. And then we had that drama of the stage where Bert got fired up. Remember he's done the timeout Durbo did on the circuit?
The rainy stage of that filthy, like oil-slicked road town where we just finished on these sketchy circuits. And basically, guys would crash. Like if you just leaned it over a little bit, you were down. So,
Bert was wanting to go the biff after the finish because he's like, you know, hard man from Shepparton, which is country Victoria here. Yeah. Like, you know,
and things were changing in the peloton with the young guys not listening to anyone and the old guys like losing their shit because,
And then I remember like guys are dropping like flies and then we had the stage at Weendog one. So it's felt like whenever we had a win, there was always this battle at the back of guys just cooked, crashing, sick. The day that Weendog won, you had Bling and Durbo, again, white as a ghost.
Yeah, crook. Barely finished that stage.
Yeah.
Yes,
we were first and like the last two on the road as well. And then they dropped off. Then the Weendog, who never gets sick, he had to pull off mid-stage. And I had the GoPro vision of him getting in the car going, fucking hell, man. I never pull out sick. This is fucking bullshit. Like, he's just angry about it. Whereas other guys are going, no, I'm sick. I need to go.
That was hidden camera. Like, that was Weendog in his essence, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even that day that Bling won, for me, all I'm thinking about is content. So they come in. Obviously, I care about the riders, but I'm thinking, shit, I've got to get the bit. And I said to Whitey, oh, how emotional are we in the car? He goes, yeah, mate, it's... started crying and I'm thinking, shit, this footage is going to be amazing. He didn't turn the fucking GoPro on. So Cam's sick. Whitey's giving me this bit and then I realized that he didn't record. I go, mate, I fucking rang you and said, was the red light flashing? You know, spraying a sports director.
One job.
One job. And then I remember once it was down to two, it was you guys and then the Italian rider we had.
Santa Marita.
and he was becoming a bit of a punish because he was pissed off. He didn't get the jersey on the first day because he was the Italian champion, but Sueno stole his thunder. And when he had the slightest nose sniffle, he was, wait here, I feel that empty. It's like, mate, you better go home. You better go home. Don't risk this. Like, fucking get him off the bus. And so normally I do an interview with guys going, you know, I have to leave the Giro or whatever. I just shot his helmet on the bus. Like, he's left. There's your overlay. So then when it was just us two, the amount of fun that we could have by having a whole bus, you had, like, support staff, like, looking after two guys. And then when we had the idea of, like, right, the last day, we're going to put the numbers on as a tribute to the guys. And ride to the start, it was a fucking 5K uphill leg snapper to the sign on. And then they, like, we did it. Like, that'll never happen again in the current climate. No one will ever be able to get up and sign on like we did that year. But it was all part of the story that we were just being authentic. Like, what would we do in that situation? Exactly what we did. We'd ride on, do a tribute, enjoy the month. And then the fact that you were lining it up, we were taking the piss pre-start. You know, I need you to get in the break. I need you to attack off the front. You know, two guys at the end just boxing on, showing, like, on the front of the pillow. I mean, it was awesome. It was awesome. And I remember you, me and Heppy catching up in Girona like 3 days after, and Heppy and I just watched that backstage like a million times the last three, because Heppy did the horses thing leading into the last day. It was just awesome, you know. It was an epic tale of 3 weeks, you know. It was epic.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's great to hear from negotiation, though.
Great times, mate. Great times. In fact, I might watch it tonight again.
Yeah. Get you fired up.
Yeah, why not?
Well, Jonesy, man, thank you. Thank you for sharing your time with us. We really enjoyed those stories. And wishing you all the best with the tour expedition and the podcasts. Yeah. It was awesome. Awesome talking to you, bud. Randy, do you have anything else you'd like to
ask you, Jonesy? For me, I mean, I was a fan, right? I was watching all the videos. Partially, it's Swain and you're in them, right? And that'd be like any race, especially if I was at the race too. You'd be like, try to get quickly debrief, see how you boys saw the day, you know? Yeah, it's awesome.
And mate, people still, I sent Swain a link. They still talk about All for One and Swain's like Buddha-esque quotes, you know. And when he talked about tribal people, you know, we come from tribal people, we're all looking to be part of a group that does something special. You know, one of the coaches here in Australia for AFL, it's like Australian Rules, is really big over here. And they had this coach that was like, he was on the out, you know, they wanted to sack him. And he went and saw All for One and it totally changed his perspective, you know. And then he started leading this group and his whole theme for the 2018 season was he put Swain's quote up on the board and all the riders bought into it. And they ended up being a kick away from winning it all that year, the grand final. And the day of the grand final, I remember ringing Swain and saying, mate, can you do a video for this coach? He loves your shit. It was a 2-page spread in the biggest paper in Melbourne about the Zen Zone, you know. It was all on Swain's quotes in this film and this coach inspired and it turned their whole season around. So don't worry about these podcasts, lads. You need to start writing sort of life coaching books on all the things that the way you see life and teach people how to do sort of kickboxer-esque tai chi, moves, tai chi.
One-liners.
Throw all that in the mix, one-liners.
Start making cards.
And start bringing in the bank. Charging corporates, you know, 10
grand.
Well,
that's what we
certainly are, man.
We certainly are all about the bank with this podcast. It's a bit ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it.
Good.
Like, what's that donut shop that you used to shit on about in Canada? Christian.
Tim Hortons.
Tim Hortons. That's who you need to go after.
Yeah. I feel like we'd be a really good fit. I think we'd be a good fit. Yeah.
Yeah.
You always wear an ideas, man, Jones. I'll give you that.
I look forward to joining you next one and complimentary doughies and brews, boys. But I can't wait. I'm going to get over to Canada one day and we'll meet up in person. As we always said, Swain, it's going to be like that last scene out of the Shawshank Redemption. You'll be sanding down a boat somewhere and then I'll roll up with like a jacket on my shoulder like Morgan Freeman and then I'll just drop the jacket and we'll stare at each other and then that's when the chopper pans out and there's this big hug and
I like it. I've always liked that imagery, Jonesy. I'm looking forward to that day, bud. Thank you.
And as I said in that famous film, mate, you just got to keep on giving her fubar.
Yeah. Wow, friends. That was awesome to catch up with Dan Jones. If you haven't ever checked out his backstage passes with the years with the team on Green Edge, Orca, they're just fantastic stuff. Good for a laugh. Good to like delve into the characters that were part of that team. And then as well, the All for One documentary, which followed the team, you know, all of his compilation of filming over those, geez, it would have been 8 or 6 years. Yeah, just fantastic stuff. Jonesy's such a good dude and so happy to catch up with him. Before we go, I wanted to touch on a few things. We are just got back last weekend from Basecamp Gravel event run in Summerlin, beautiful Summerlin, by our good friend Jesse. He pulled off an awesome job organizing this sweet event. A bunch of people from all over the province and Alberta even rolled out and camped and rode some awesome loops out in the Summerland area, part of the Kettle Valley railway system. And yeah, just fantastic. So if you're in for a good time, a good camp out, meet some friends next year, definitely sign up for that one. That was just a really good vibe there. As well, coming up on June 18th, Randy and I are going to be at the Ex Fondo gravel event up in Whistler. So that's going to be a good time. If you're keen on checking that out and joining us, please check out the Ex Fondo website. I believe they're also on Instagram at ITExFondo. And then I'd like to thank our sponsor. Oh, I forgot to mention, we're going to be riding out to the Fernie Gravel Grind after that. That's the following weekend. Randy and I will be riding from Nelson. So yeah, definitely join us out in Fernie. That's a super beautiful part of the world. And our friend Carter is, puts on a great event. So we're looking forward to that. And then we'd like to thank our sponsors, which are Seven Mesh. Fantastic cycling clothing, especially for this part of the world and this rubbish spring we've had. And KDX Wheels, yeah, best damn wheels I've ridden. And Shimano. Shimano supported me, I think Randy probably as well, for the majority of our careers, and they're still helping us out. So, yeah, thank you, guys. And Laser Helmets, yeah. Guys, super comfy helmets. I'm not going to go on any further than that. Please share with your friends. Like I said, we're trying to put out some good interviews and some funny interviews and all that stuff. And if you have feedback, whatever, we're keen to hear it. And catch you next time.